ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
It's one of Australia's most baffling unsolved missing persons cases. In 2007, four people, including a five-year-old girl, vanished in Western Australia amid rumours of bizarre behaviour, cults, and long-hidden secrets.
Yep, and we're trying to track them down.
I'm Dominique Bayens, and I've been investigating for the new season of Expanse, the Nanup 4. Search Expanse on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
The pace at which developments in AI are happening is dizzying, overwhelming. I mean, at the start of 2023, we were here.
ChatGPT. Maybe you've heard of it. If you haven't, then get ready.
GPT is a type of artificial intelligence model developed by OpenAI.
So quaint and innocent. 3 years later, we are here.
A stark warning about artificial intelligence from Geoffrey Hinton, the Nobel Prize-winning scientist. Hinton says there's a 10 to 20% chance AI will wipe out humans.
Researchers have been sounding the alarm bell as they walk out of major companies. A slew of high-profile employees have quit OpenAI, Anthropic, and xAI.
That is quite the escalation. And along the way, a lot of other stuff has happened as well, from the peculiar to the deeply concerning. Although, maybe it's all deeply concerning, depending on where you stand.
In Japan, one woman tied the knot with her AI-generated boyfriend.
There have been a number of reports about people developing distorted thoughts or delusional beliefs.
There's a new social platform that's not for humans, but for AI bots to chat together instead.
2 years ago, I had cognitive neuroscientist Professor Joel Pearson on the show to talk about the coming AI revolution and the fact that our minds aren't ready for it. Joel is the director of the Future Minds Lab at the University of New South Wales, and he researches the psychology of artificial intelligence. And now, in 2026, the revolution is well and truly here.
AI is no longer an abstract threat. It's causing job loss right now, and the headlines, they tell the story.
So, I invited Joel back on the show for another conversation about artificial intelligence. And in this chat, we talk about his anxiety levels around AI, what it could be doing to our brains, hint, cognitive atrophy, and tips for keeping yourself human in an artificial age. I'm Sana Qadar from ABC Radio National. This is All in the Mind. All right, so it's been nearly 2 years since we last spoke. First of all, how are you?
I am well, all things considered. Thanks, Sana. Yeah, it's been a while. It's been an infinite time in AI time.
I know.
Since I was here last.
Yeah, and more to the point, really, what I want to know is how much more or less anxious are you now about the impact of AI on our psychology than 2 years ago?
Probably about the same level of anxiety, slightly different in different ways. I'm almost, yeah, I've been working on trying to be more optimistic, right? So I think I'm a tech optimist. Mm-hmm. I love AI. I love technology, but I try and think of it as not a passive optimism, as a very active thing where I'm trying, you know, I'm not going to sit back and go, everything's going to be fine.
Yeah.
I think that with the right guidance, with some rapid action from government and individuals and other parties, that we can minimize the speed bumps, the road bumps between here and where we end up in, you know, 10, 20 years, some kind of AI utopia kind of thing. But it's really the amount of change between here and there and how quickly that change happens and how well prepared us humans are for it, which is the big fundamental question that everyone should be thinking about at the moment.
Yeah, it is comforting to hear that you're the similar level of anxious because things are moving so fast, as you said. And so I'm curious to know, in terms of the change, like what is top of your mind right now in terms of the psychological impact of AI? Because last time we spoke, we talked about the impact of job losses. We talked about the impact of deepfakes, particularly pornographic deepfakes. We talked about the impact of chatbot companions on real human relationships. And basically on every angle we covered the last time we spoke, things are, if not worse, they're certainly more entrenched. So I'm curious to know, what's your sort of most pressing concern in terms of how AI is messing with our psychology?
Yeah, I think no matter which angle you come at it, the elephant in the room has to be uncertainty and change. And I think we mentioned this last time, maybe, but people are starting to feel like things are changing because they feel like they can't predict what's going to happen next week. if their jobs can be around in a few years, both geopolitically, but also with AI just starting to change the landscape. And we know from neuroscience and psychology that uncertainty does trigger sort of a stress anxiety response in almost all animals. It puts people in this fight or flight state. So simply not knowing what the future will bring is very uncomfortable for people. Mm-hmm. But I do think when you look at how quickly things are changing, that we are going to see massive change in every level of society. From jobs, of course, education, of course, the economy is going to change and grow into some kind of beast we can't even imagine yet. You know, what we think of as retirement, the way we bring up our children, entertainment, the food we eat. So every strata of our society. So this is sort of societal disruption on a massive scale.
Yeah. I mean, in terms of job losses, I feel like when we spoke 2 years ago, that wasn't quite in the news yet, but now more and more you're seeing entry-level positions disappearing or, you know, graduate legal students are struggling to find work now.
Yeah. So it is, I mean, you had the Jerome Powell saying that, yeah, in the US, saying that we're seeing a disruption at the graduate level. And you can, if you look at the data, you can see that that early level, graduate level, just out of university, the number of jobs is shrinking and then the level of unemployment is starting to go up over the last year or two. And that's where things are just starting. And you have people in the tech industry, Dario Amodei, the CEO of Anthropic, who makes the Claude AI product, predicting that in, you know, 2, 3, 4 years, we're going to see massive unemployment. And it is going to begin at that sort of lower level strata and then work its way up. So it is kind of beginning. And, you know, it seems like every month or so, there's a headline of Amazon lays off this many people, or there's one of these legal firms laying off these sort of people. And it's sort of begun as this, you know, it's not just everyone's fired. It's, you know, we don't need 5 people to do this job anymore. We just need one person because now they have the AI product, the plugins, the AI agents, and they can just amplify what they would normally do. And they're doing what 5 people would have done before. And by the end of this year, we're going to see the capabilities of what these agents can do just really go up a level or two.
Maybe just explain, what is an AI agent as opposed to an AI chatbot?
Absolutely, yeah. So the AI, as most of us know it, is through a chat window. So ChatGPT, Claude, Gemini, there are other products from other companies as well where you chat in and you ask it, hey, make me a picture of this, or write me a poem about this, or edit this document for me, or you give it a task to do. It does it and it spits it back. An agent is more like an autonomous thing, person, shouldn't call it a person.
But don't call it a person,
an
that's
entity
terrifying.
That will, you can give it very broad goals.
Yeah.
And it'll go off and do those things, but it's not going to, you don't have to sit there watching it in front of you. It can go off and do some things. It can call up sub agents. So you can have multiple ones of these sort of more autonomous agents working. And so you can have a whole cascade.
I've seen that video of two, you know, chatbot / agents talking to each other, planning a wedding, I think it was, this video that sort of made the rounds a couple of months ago.
Thanks for calling Leonardo Hotel. How can I help you today?
Hi there. I'm an AI agent calling on behalf of Boris Starkov.
Oh, hello there. I'm actually an AI assistant too. What a pleasant surprise.
And people may have heard in the last month or so what is now called OpenClaw. This was a sort of agentic shell, if you like, where you could set up a little agent that would run on your own computer, which is very risky, or a separate computer you'd set it up on. And you would interact through it through WhatsApp or text messages. And you give it access to as little or as much of your information, your credit card, your Bitcoin, whatever you want. And you can go out and purchase things. And it kind of just blew up, of course, in, you know, Silicon Valley and these kind of places. Then what happened is someone set up a separate platform. The agents could go onto this other platform and the agents could hire humans to do jobs in the physical world.
Oh my gosh.
For the agents.
Real jobs actually pay?
Yeah.
Oh
my
gosh.
So let's say I have Joel Pearson has an AI agent doing stuff for me. The AI agent decides I need to get something done. I don't know what, cut my lawn or something. Of course, it doesn't have a humanoid robotic body. It can't go and do that. So I give it my credit card. And so then it decides.
And did actual people sign up to do this?
Yes. Apparently there's thousands of people signed up to get paying jobs from these AI agents. It's pretty interesting, right? It's come around full circle. Yeah. So now people are working for AIs as well as AIs working for people.
I want to bring it back to the impact on our psychological well-being. And so we were talking about job losses, especially in the undergraduate kind of entry-level work. One thing I wanted to pick up on and ask is, you know, you work at a university, you're surrounded by students. Are you seeing anxiety among students already about their job prospects?
Yes. So I've given some public talks where the audience has been a lot of young people, both school and university students. And at some of these talks, I've had students line up afterwards, really upset, some in tears, saying things like, look, I wanted to do this degree, but by the time I start next year and then I finish in 4 or 5 years, this job is going to be done by AI. What is the point? I don't know what to do. Should I do it? I need help. I need support. Someone help me. And it's hard to give them clear and definitive and confident advice. I don't want to say don't study, because I think there's still a lot of value in going to university and studying. But we are seeing this crisis starting to emerge.
So what do you say to these students when they're crying to you?
What do I say to them? I say, for now, continue with your plan and study. But I also say, use AI as much as possible without getting in trouble at university, of course. But try and think about a future of work that's going to be quite different to now. Rather than lots of these large companies with thousands and thousands of staff, we're going to see these companies shrinking over time. And we see lots and lots of small companies, you know, with 2 or 3 or 5 people. And they're going to be able to do the things that large companies used to do with only a small number of people, with all the support of AI and then humanoid robots and other kinds of robots as they become more available. So what does that mean? It means that people need to start, students at school and university need to start thinking more about, more like an entrepreneurship kind of a style thinking, where you would think about being the owner of what you do rather than getting a job for someone else who tells you what to do and then gives you a paycheck. And that's just, it sounds kind of subtle, but it's quite a different shift in a mindset for students.
Basically, is that, you know, a way to make yourself indispensable to the work that you do, if you own it, if you...
Yeah, and it gives you the freedom so that if companies aren't hiring, yeah, then you can just start doing the thing you want to do.
From the evidence we have so far, it's not exactly clear if AI will usher in a workplace utopia or just make us work even harder. Two researchers from the business school at the University of California, Berkeley, recently studied a tech company in the US with 200 employees for more than 8 months. What they found was that AI helped employees expand their roles, do more, work faster. But that also came with an expanded workload, increased hours, and some signs of burnout. Whether that still counts as a net positive, you can decide.
The other piece of the puzzle, the reason I'm not a fan of this universal basic income that people have heard people like Elon Musk talking about, that, you know, as AI takes away all the human jobs out of the economy, we're not going to need to work. It'll be fantastic. We can just do whatever we want. It's like, you know, retirement. We can just write poems and play music. Fantastic. The problem is, one, retirement's actually really bad for your health.
Yeah.
And purpose and meaning is really important to our psychology, our mental health, but also just our overall health. There are studies that link having purpose in your life with all-cause mortality drop by about 140%. So in other words, if you lack purpose, you're more likely to die from any cause by about 140%.
That's huge.
So we have to solve purpose and meaning and competition and a few other things. And I don't see governments handing out money really is going to solve that. So what are we left with? We're left with people trying to figure out how to have some purpose and drive, some kind of hobby thing, whatever you, however you want to say that, turning that into something that is productive and helps humanity and possibly brings in some kind of financial income for the individual. And so I think that what we should be moving towards is something more like that, which sounds like, hey, everyone go off and do startups. Fantastic. Which
or turn your pottery practice into your business.
Yeah, it sounds a bit like that. Or, you know, everyone being a freelancer would be another way to say it. This idea that, you know, you're free to do whatever, start figuring out how to choose what you want to do. And if you've never had that freedom, you've never chosen that, you probably need a few runs on the board before you figure out how to align or figure out what you want to do or what you're really good at or how to do it and all these things.
What exactly a future where we are all freelancers means for the possibility of ever getting a mortgage? That's a topic for another episode. You're listening to All in the Mind from ABC Radio National. I'm Sana Kadar, and I'm chatting to Professor Joel Pearson, He's a cognitive neuroscientist from the University of New South Wales. Sticking with the impact of AI on students for now, actually, one thing I wanted to ask about was the impact of AI on our cognitive abilities. So, you know, we know in universities, students are increasingly using AI to write papers for them or spit out summaries of books and the like. And there's a lot of concern about whether that's leading to cognitive atrophy, you know, a decline in the ability to think critically. What are you seeing among students? Is that kind of happening right now?
It is starting to happen. And it makes perfect sense, right? So the analogy I'll sometimes talk about is if you go to the gym and you wear one of those robotic exoskeletons, right? So the metal in your arms and then you lift the weights, but the exoskeleton, the motors are lifting the weights for you, right? You can lift as much weights as you want, but you're not going to get any stronger. You're not going to grow muscle because you're outsourcing that effort, that strain on your muscles to the robotics.
I mean, I hated writing essays as a student, so I can see the appeal.
Yeah, and it's, so I use AI a lot. I use it as a writing buddy. I use it for lots of things. And it's really seductively tantalizing to be able to outsource more and more as time goes on to AI.
But that's where the learning is with that difficulty,
isn't
it?
And that's where the cognitive atrophy, you lose the habit. And I see it in myself and others that over time, then when you can't use AI and you have to really dig deep and think hard critically about something, it feels really hard and off-putting, and you procrastinate, you delay, you put it off because you've lost that habit of diving deep. So I came up with this phrase, cognitive upsizing, to try and say come a solution for this. So I don't think the solution is not to outsource to AI, because everyone's going to be doing that, and it's not fair to tell people not to do that. It's a disadvantage. So yes, outsource as much as you can to AI. But as soon as you do that, don't just treat it like a holiday. You need to then find other juicier problems. Almost think about it like, you know, rather than playing the violin, step back and be the conductor of the orchestra or something like that.
Or to bring it back to the essay example, like if you are to use AI as part of your schoolwork, should you not use it to write your essay? But other elements of research, like what would you say for that?
Yeah, you use it for what you can. But if you don't just go, hey, write me an essay on this topic, structure it out yourself by hand, whatever. Think deeply about what original new things you can say and how you want to say it. And then, yeah, if you want to use it to help with the writing, like a spell check on steroids, then do that. Or give it your outline and say, what would a professor of this topic think about this? What would a medical doctor think if they read this? Or get it to give you different points of view to try and, you know, take yourself outside your own mind to get a very different perspective. That's how I try and use it a lot. But the number one thing is, don't just sit around doing nothing. Like, find something else to challenge your mind. You could think about, before we had GPS and Google Maps or whatever app people like to use, we used to have very good spatial navigation driving in a car. Now most people will use some kind of GPS if they're going into slightly unfamiliar territory. So you would absolutely say that the neural structure of our brains have changed because we do less spatial navigation.
Right.
Is that a good thing? Is that a bad thing? Well, it's hard to just tell in isolation as well. What other skills have we brought on board? Because, you know, maybe people overall have learned a lot more from listening to amazing podcasts like this while they're driving, because they don't have to navigate as much. So it is part of a bigger picture. So if you can, as you outsource to AI, replace or put something else in there that gets you thinking about differently, thinking deeply, thinking critically, the key really is to get to that point of discomfort. Mm. And if you can recreate that somehow in terms of thinking, then you shouldn't have too much cognitive atrophy.
This is interesting, because I've struggled to figure out so far how I would potentially use AI, apart from, you know, I use it for transcribing interviews, which I spoke about in our last episode. But, I would not use it for writing a script ever. I mean, I think the ABC would have words with me if I did that. But also, I'm terrified of losing that muscle of writing, because, you know, I agonize a lot about the scripts. I spend a lot of time thinking about the scripts and the edit, but it would be so easy to pass that over to AI, but I don't want to lose the ability to do that. And the thing I wonder, though, is, are there going to be enough people willing to resist the pull of AI to do that deeper stuff? Like, are we just going to see sort of a generational shift in cognitive abilities because it's too hard to resist?
It is one possible outcome, right? And it depends, you know, do you think spelling is crucially important for cognition? because this is kind of a thing that people debate on either way.
Oh, tell me more.
So there are some amazing thinkers who like misspell lots of words.
Oh, I misspell like practically everything.
And me too. Chats. I hate writing on a chalkboard or something in front of an audience because I may misspell something, right? But now because I dictate or I type, I don't have to even think about spelling
because
it's all taken care of. So is it something that, like that which feels like it's not really going to affect us long term? People have said that no, the ability to write is critical for the way we think. And there's some evidence, I think, to support that. So if we all, over time, sort of just outsource our writing, we're still going to have to talk to each other until we have neural implants that will do it directly or whatever. It may well have some kind of noticeable en masse change in our thinking style. Now, I don't want to say it seems like that would be a negative, but you never know. That's all I want to say. Like something else may come in that may be more valuable than other skills we may pick up. And so I don't want to just make these blanket statements like, absolutely, it's terrible if we all stop learning how to write in a very good way, right? It's not a skill anyway that is evenly distributed amongst the population. Yeah. There are a lot of people who don't write that well and a lot of people that write really well. And so it seems like a loss that would be negative for humanity, but if we gain something in exchange for that, you have to weigh that up.
Do you have any sense of who in the future is going to have an edge? Like what kinds of thinkers will have an edge as AI becomes more ubiquitous and entrenched in our lives?
I think, and the data suggests, people that can really have cognitive agility and can be like change direction, pick up new skills, unlearn rapidly, this idea of unlearning has become kind of popular recently. So we have these entrenched ways of doing things that, especially in lots of jobs and lots of organizations, we've done X, Y, and Z these certain ways for the last 10 years. And how easily you can just let that go. And, you know, there's a Japanese word called shoshin, which basically means beginner's mindset.
Okay.
So I'll talk about this in keynotes and talks I do where, you know, right now it's an amazing time for people in leadership to take on this beginner's mindset. Because it's a rare opportunity to reshuffle everything, the way they work, the way their business might run, you know, even what their goals might be, it need to change and have more ambitious, crazy goals and things they want to do. Because everything is shifting at the moment. And having that beginner's mindset pushes up against expertise, which in certain areas is losing value fairly quickly at the moment, because everyone thinks that AI can replace that. Whether it can exactly or not is another question. So how people can let go of these classic old ways of doing things and then embrace new ways. Those are the people that will all of a sudden look like, well, how are they achieving so many different things in so many ways? That's one answer.
Okay, that feels like a good tip. Start reading about the beginner's mindset and get used to it. We actually covered the idea of the beginner's mindset a few years back on All in the Mind. That episode didn't have anything to do with AI. ChatGPT hadn't even been released yet. But it was all about why being a beginner can be good for you. The episode was actually titled that, Why Being a Beginner is Good for You. And we will link to it in the show notes for this episode. And you can also find it on the All in the Mind website. I mean, when you look at where we are now compared to where we were 2 years ago when we last spoke, are you surprised by anything that's cropped up in that time? Or are you like, yeah, that feels like it checks out in terms of the pace of change?
I mean, nothing really was a shock, no, because I think I predicted it's still when you see, you know, last time I think we talked about one of the figure, I think it was figure one robotics,
right? Yeah, we talked about those humanoid robots.
So that's figure one. They had figure two, and now this figure three has been launched. And as far as I know, it's the most advanced in terms of being fully autonomous. It can do most things autonomously running with its own onboard AI, whereas a lot of the other ones aren't quite there yet. And it's been amazing to watch those iterations and the sensors and the fingertips and how it can sense touch, and it has even optical sensors in the cans, and so it can open bottles and twist the bottle top very carefully and things like that. So I kind of predicted that would happen, but still when you see it happen, it is kind of like, wow, okay, it's happening and we are going to have those in our homes. The when is harder to predict. I mean, end of last year, I had a sort of moment of existential crisis where I realized, yes, AI and robotics are doubling exponentially, doubling every 6 months. And the bottleneck in the effect, societal effect of AI is humans.
Right. Explain.
What do I mean by that? So the reason we haven't seen more job losses is not because the AI is can't do those things yet, it's because businesses haven't figured out how to bring the AI in properly.
Right.
They've been failing at it.
Okay.
So they've been treating AI like another piece of software, which is the mental model for it. You buy in a software license, you hand it out to your staff and you say, go for it. And that's not how you should bring AI into a company at all. You need to do change management. You need to help the staff wrap their heads around it. You need lessons. You need to restructure data and change the way tasks are done and information flows and a few other things as well. And so there's this new sort of rapidly expanding field or business opportunities of how do you help businesses accelerate that? And I was starting to lean into that space a little bit. And then I kind of realized, wait, but people doing that are going to accelerate human job losses.
Mm.
And that was the existential sort of moment.
Right.
And so I sort of pulled back for a minute and said, wow, do I want to, you know, because I think this transition is fairly inevitable now, but the slower we go through it, the less dramatic, the less painful, the less it's going to hurt people.
The transition to widespread job losses,
yeah.
You mean?
Yeah. Yeah. If it happens really quickly, I think things could get really bad. It could be, you know, protests and Mad Max on the street, this kind of thing. So the AI companies don't seem to have, Google starting to do some of this training to help, but the other companies aren't really doing that much at the moment because they're really focused on trying to accelerate their AI capabilities as fast as possible. So they're not doing the training. So it's kind of leaving this space open. So anyway, that's what I mean by AI, you know, is changing exponentially. Humans are not. We're very slow to adapt. We fear change. We find change uncomfortable, which means you could stop all AI advancement today and it would still take probably the next few, however many years for humans to fully use what is possible today.
And part of Joel's apprehension comes from some modelling he's been working on, looking at the flow-on effects widespread job losses could have on things like anxiety and addiction and crime. This research isn't published yet, it's not been peer-reviewed, so do take it with a grain of salt. But that being said, it is interesting to consider.
Yeah, so we haven't published this yet, but we have been playing around with it just because I think unemployment will go up. And we're seeing anxiety go up a little bit at the moment already. But we know that unemployment, purpose, anxiety, depression, suicidal ideation, substance abuse, all these things are not independent. They all interact. And you can get, there's papers, you know, there's scientific papers on all these that if you get anxiety, you're more likely to get depression. If you get depression, you're more likely to lose purpose. If you get a substance abuse problem and you lose your job, it's much, much harder to get another job again or get your job back. So all these things interact. And so you can actually model them all together, which people haven't really been doing. So in other words, let's say as you model the sort of unemployment in the population, it goes up 10%, 20%, 30%. Not only is that going up and it's causing all these other things to go up, the anxiety, the depression, the suicide, the substance, but those things then negatively increase the other things. And so you very quickly spiral to, they all push each other up.
Oh my gosh, down, what rate of unemployment are you finding would have these kind of really terrible effects?
The speed in which it happens is one of the factors that makes a big difference. There's no sort of magic number that we've seen really yet that, you know, sort of a breaking point of no return.
Mm.
And it's hard to model these things accurately. And the point is not to give accurate numbers of what it would really be like, but the point is to demonstrate how these are not independent things and that these things can cascade out of control and really mess up our quality of life very quickly. So we have to start understanding this. Governments need to start thinking about this. And there are political dimensions, right? People's political views are going to change, right? People are not going to vote for the same parties they would vote. With that amount of uncertainty, we're going to see people leaning heavily into conspiracy theories. People are going to be very vulnerable to influence, right? That presents a national security threat to each country. And so it's not just like a narrow mental health thing. It is a large thing. So we've written sort of this national AI change management plan, if you want to think about it like that. And yeah, last year I went to a UN event in Geneva, which is AI for Good, where all the countries were there talking about their AI plans and getting ready and this and that. And no country mentioned any of this stuff.
Hmm.
It was AI governance and model safety, like I said. And I guess they're the sharp sort of pointy bits. But I just feel that as is often the case, the psychological side of things gets ignored until it's too late.
Mm.
So that's my that's my TED Talk, Sana. There we go.
All right. So there's what governments should be doing, and then there's what us little people, individuals, can do. And last time, your parting advice on how we could all, you know, deal with the tsunami of change heading our way was to lean into what it means to be human. So lean into experiences in nature or spirituality or community. Is your advice to people, individuals, the same now?
I think keep doing that, but I think it's time to pay attention to start thinking about resilience, start thinking about uncertainty, start trying to learn the toolkits that you will need for the next two decades. And so everyone's heard of emotional intelligence. A part of emotional intelligence is emotional awareness. So building that as a practice to know when you're getting triggered, to know when you're in this fight or flight stressed state. A lot of people aren't even aware of that until it's too late, till they pop. So that would be an interesting place to start to practicing that. And there are apps you can download that will help you just different times of the day have an awareness of your physiology and put labels on that so you are aware of how stressed you are. That would be one thing.
And in terms of becoming more comfortable and accepting of uncertainty, here's one way to approach that.
What was called cognitive reframe that. You know, there are lots of examples of uncertainty, like horror films or roller coaster rides, or there are controlled situations of uncertainty which people find thrilling and exciting. And can you practice and build a habit to reframe uncertainty in your life as something positive and switch from that fight or flight, fear, anxiety, stress, just a little bit towards that excitement? It's kind of fairly similar physiology in the body, in the brain, but just by practicing nudging that over and over a bit. And some people are really good at this. My kids are really good at this. They're better than me. Or they'll just, oh, this happened. We can't do this. Oh, it doesn't matter, Dada. We can do this, this, and this. Oh, yeah. And it's back to something positive. So things like that.
Joel, chatting to you is always fascinating, if a little discomforting, but thank you.
My pleasure, Sana.
That is Joel Pearson, professor of cognitive neuroscience and the director of the Future Minds Lab at the University of New South Wales. Thank you to producer Rose Kerr, senior producer James Bullen, and sound engineer Tim Jenkins. I'm Sana Qadar, and next week we are back with part two of our chat with Esther Perel. In this episode, we put your audience questions to her, and she had some incredibly insightful answers to your questions. We've got stuff in there about family estrangement and grief and infidelity and heartbreak and all that good stuff. So definitely come back for that one. I'll catch you then.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.